This hour, as she will soon be inducted into the Gospel Hall of Fame, we pay her a measure of what she so richly deserves. Good morning, I'm Kathleen Dunn. Last week, the Gospel Music Hall of Fame announced that Aretha Franklin would be inducted in August. She started singing in the Baptist Church when she was just a child, and it was at the New Temple Missionary Church in Watts where her iconic album Amazing Grace was recorded.
God will take care. He'll take care of you. I know he will.
Our guest this hour says the album Amazing Grace is more influential than any of her internationally adored secular songs. The record sold 2 million copies and is, to this day, the biggest-selling album of her entire career. With me this hour to talk about Aretha Franklin's gospel roots and later career is Aaron Cohen. He's written a terrific book about the making of the album Amazing Grace and also looks at the life history of Aretha Franklin. He's reviews editor for Downbeat Magazine and author of Amazing Grace. And Aaron, thank you so much for being with us. I could just sit and listen to her all hour. I just love the music. I'm sure you could, too. And when we look at her gospel roots, it's interesting you say that she began in the church, and she really never left the church. She stayed on her own terms. But we don't think of her in the church, usually, do we? We think of Respect. We think of other popular hits.
Well, exactly. Also, first of all, let me say thank you very much.
Our pleasure.
Here. I went to school in Wisconsin, so it's great to be on Wisconsin Public Radio. But to get back to your question, yes, I mean, her secular hits were so popular. We hear Respect, we hear Think, we hear Chain of Fools all the time. We hear them not just as songs in and of themselves, but also on soundtracks, on commercials, constant airplay. However, as you just said, she began in the church. Her father was a prominent minister. She grew up singing gospel. Many of her early heroes as singers were gospel singers. And she, like I say, never left the church. She always would sing gospel. She would lead these revivals. She's always either at gospel funerals for the major stars who've passed on, or she sends messages or flowers. And, of course, she recorded Amazing Grace, which is her biggest-selling album. And she recorded it in 1972 in the early 90s. It went double platinum. It's been selling ever since. And I believe it's also her artistic peak, too, as a singer. I think it is one where she was really able to stretch out as a singer. Those hits, as great as they are, Respect, Chain of Fools, you know, she had to sing in two-minute segments. She had to sing these pop singles. With Amazing Grace, she could sing for 11 minutes. She could sing for 12 minutes. She could sing for as long or as short as she wanted. She had that freedom that she richly deserved as a singer.
Mm-hmm. You talk about how she took on a lot of the tradition of the black church as well, that a lot of the music on Amazing Grace goes back a generation before hers, maybe even more than that, and she took it on in a very full, rich fashion, all of the songs that her grandparents had sung.
Well, not necessarily her grandparents, but her father, for sure, because gospel itself as a genre really began in the early 1930s with Thomas A. Dorsey and, Take My Hand, Precious Lord, which sort of was considered the first gospel song, the song that merged an older form of spirituals with blues and created this new genre called gospel, was only really around for, say, 40 years before Aretha Franklin recorded Amazing Grace. And had become a very popular form of music within the African-American community. And, of course, it was extremely used throughout the church, the Baptist church, the Pentecostal church, in the United States. And Aretha Franklin grew up in that tradition. She grew up with her father, the Reverend C.L. Franklin, being a very prominent minister in Detroit, a friend and advisor to the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. And he was also sort of the host for visiting gospel musicians, the gospel singer Clara Ward, who was an early inspiration for Aretha Franklin and for many other young gospel singers, was sort of a companion to her father. And she was actually in the church when Aretha sang and recorded Amazing Grace. And then Aretha Franklin, with this album, mixed this tradition that had gone back two generations, 40 years, with more current pop songs. Precious Lord, she and the Reverend James Cleveland, who did the arrangements, mixed with You've Got a Friend, the current Carole King hit. She also brought in Holy Holy, which was a song that Marvin Gaye had written in the church tradition, but was certainly a secular song, and she made it into a gospel song.
Aaron, you write that there is no reason to doubt that since she was born, Aretha Franklin heard Mahalia Jackson sing Precious Lord, Take My Hand. There's an interesting family connection there, and she's frequently compared to, not frequently, but she occasionally is compared to Mahalia Jackson. Two questions here. What was the family connection, and is there a legitimate comparison?
Well, I think that, there is certainly, the connection is that not only was Mahalia Jackson an influential gospel singer and certainly a very popular across-the-board singer, but Aretha Franklin's mother left the family when Aretha was quite young, and her mother died when Aretha was 10. So there were these surrogate mothers in her life who would come into the house and help cook, help take care of the children, and Mahalia Jackson was certainly one of those surrogate mothers to her. Aretha Franklin, when she was a young girl and was singing on the gospel circuit, was singing in these revivals and in these concerts across the country with Mahalia Jackson. Mahalia Jackson, though, as a singer, was certainly not as much of a direct influence as Clara Ward. Clara Ward's phrasing, Clara Ward's range, was more closer to Aretha Franklin than Mahalia Jackson's. However, Mahalia Jackson, as we know, you know, she sang for Dr. Martin Luther King. Mahalia Jackson sang at Kennedy's inaugural, and then Aretha Franklin sang at Barack Obama's inaugural. And both Mahalia Jackson and Aretha Franklin were close to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King. So those other connections, whether it's the familial connection of Mahalia Jackson being in the house, or their connections with presidents and with Dr. King, are certainly important. So in terms of iconography, the connections between Mahalia Jackson and Aretha Franklin are certainly there, even though as a singer, Clara Ward is certainly closer to Aretha than Mahalia was.
All right, well, let's listen to a little bit of those singers, starting with Mahalia Jackson, and then we'll hear a little bit of Clara Ward.
Right.
And then we'll hear a little bit of Aretha to
That's
see what
great.
We think. All right.
That's great.
All right, here's Mahalia.
Precious Lord, take my hand, lead me on, and let me stand.
Mahalia Jackson and one of her most famous songs, Precious Lord. We wanted to compare the voices here, so we're going to listen now. Our guest, Aaron, says that Aretha sounds more like Clara Ward, another influence on Aretha.
Thank you.
And now Aretha Franklin, and this is from that album that remains her best-selling album of all time, Amazing Grace. Aretha Franklin coming up now. Aretha Franklin with Amazing Grace. That was recorded in 1972, and before that we were trying to get a comparison of influences on her, and Clara Ward was before that. You can hear some of the similarities, and Mahalia Jackson before that. A couple things. One, you're struck immediately, Aaron, by the interaction with congregants.
Absolutely.
When Aretha sings, it adds a whole new element in her pop songs as well, don't you think?
Oh, I think so, too. I think there's that directness, but the back and forth between Aretha Franklin and this church audience was particularly striking. In this album, when it came out in 1972 and when it was recorded, there was a sort of post, it was a part of the sort of what we call the post-civil rights era, and there was a sort of a newfound black consciousness, a black terms of black community and black pride that her father had been actually preaching for decades, and she mentions that that when the sort of black arts movement, the new black aesthetic came about, she said that for her it was nothing new. It was something that her father had always been very involved in, and so Aretha Franklin was front and center as a part of all of that. In fact, for the book, when I was talking with her friend Nikki Giovanni about, well, you know, how did Aretha Franklin fit into the black aesthetic at the time, and Nikki Giovanni very politely cut me off and said, well, Aretha Franklin was the black aesthetic. And that, I think that is in the purest form when she's in the church and when she is in front of this church, and the way they're responding to her is really clear.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about, tell me if she had a leg up because of who her father was, and you write Aretha was, or maybe Nikki Giovanni said this, Aretha was a princess.
Yeah,
she came with credentials, so she had to be taken seriously.
Right.
That was Nikki's comment.
That's Nikki's comment, yes. Well, that's definitely true, and I think part of it is because, well, from a very early age, Aretha Franklin had such close access to her heroes. I mentioned in the book that it was one thing for, say, the Beatles or the Rolling Stones to, you know, draw inspiration from their sources, Chuck Berry or Little Richard, but Aretha Franklin had these heroes in her home. You know, Chuck Berry and Little Richard weren't surrounding the Beatles and the Rolling Stones in person when they were growing up, but with Aretha, that was certainly the case. As I mentioned earlier, Clara Ward and Mahalia Jackson were there in her house when she was a girl, but also so were blues singers like Dinah Washington, jazz pianists like Art Tatum were all in Aretha Franklin's house when she was little, and so she drew from all of them. And then also, too, as I had mentioned earlier, her early exposure to Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who was close with her father, so she was front and center of the civil rights movement while it was happening, and so she was drawing inspiration from these musical icons. At the same time, she was front and center with this new wave of progressive black leaders.
Can you imagine being in the same house with Art Tatum playing piano and Aretha singing? Oh, my goodness. Oh, my.
Yes, yes.
That would have been A-OK.
Yes, and it's really interesting, too, because on the Amazing Grace album, the choir was led by Reverend James Cleveland, who was a very important gospel composer and choir leader, especially in California. And he was 11 years older than Aretha Franklin, but he was also in the Franklin household. He lived there for a while and would show Aretha Franklin some things on piano. And so he had his style of piano playing. You'd guess, like Art Tatum showing Aretha Franklin his way of piano playing. So as a singer and pianist, he was struck by all of these different influences from very early on.
We'll play James Cleveland in a moment. Let's go back for just a moment, though, to Clara Ward. We'll remember her voice, which I think is strikingly similar to Aretha's, the timbre of it.
Yes, yes.
Do you think that she was the greatest influence on Aretha then?
I would say that, you know, it's hard to qualify with absolutes, but although I do think this is her best album, so I can make that absolute statement. But as far as greatest influence, well, certainly Clara Ward was certainly a great one. She'd be up there. If I was to list the top three or four influences on Aretha Franklin as a singer, I would say Clara Ward certainly would be in that top three or four.
Mm-hmm. And let's listen to a bit of the Reverend James Cleveland, another strong influence on her gospel music.
Master, the tempest is raging. Oh, the billows are tossing high. The sky is o'ershadowed with blackness.
You talk, Aaron, about Cleveland bringing his choirs to this high level of precision, but never worked with a more accomplished rhythm section than on this album, primarily Aretha Franklin's working band.
Well, that was a great band, and one of the great joys of working on this book was speaking to the members of that band. There was the wonderful drummer, Bernard Pretty Purdy, the bassist, Chuck Rainey, and the guitarist, Cornell Dupree, who we just lost last year. And this was a fantastic, fantastic band. They were able to draw on jazz. They were able to draw on funk and R&B and blues and had such quick precision, and they were just so in tune with each other that it was just a very, very high level of musicianship.
Aaron Cohen is our guest this hour. Aretha Franklin will be, it was announced last week, that she will be inducted in August of this year into the Gospel Music Hall of Fame. And we're looking at her gospel music, which I think is a bit overlooked. Our guest says the album Amazing Grace, her best-selling album, remains frequently overlooked. Amazingly, when Rolling Stone named her the greatest singer of the rock era in 2008, Amazing Grace wasn't even mentioned. Well, we're more than mentioning it this hour, and we'll welcome phone calls, too. If you'd like to join our conversation, here's how you can do it. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Aaron Cohen is reviews editor for Downbeat Magazine, and he is the author of Amazing Grace. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you
Aretha Franklin with one of her better-known, adored secular songs. We're talking about Aretha this hour. and she's going to be inducted in the Gospel Music Hall of Fame in August. We're welcoming phone calls, too, if you want to talk about Aretha's life, about her music. The phone lines are open to you this morning. We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655. Aaron Cohen, who is reviews editor for Downbeat Magazine and author of a wonderful book on the recording of Amazing Grace and the life of Aretha Franklin, is our guest this hour. What about some of those secular songs? Was she doing the secular music simultaneously with the gospel music, Aaron?
Well, she was. And, you know, also one of the great things about her as a singer is that she, of course, brought that gospel style of singing to her secular songs. I mean, you can hear in a song, even in a song like Respect, there was a gospel singer named Jackie Verdell who was very influential in terms of that way of Aretha Franklin phrasing that song. And in songs like Spirit in the Dark, which was a secular song she had recorded slightly before Amazing Grace, you know, what she means by spirit and the way she sings spirit, especially in a great live duet with Ray Charles at Live at the Fillmore, you know, the lines are not so clearly drawn when she sings a song like that. And and that was true with a lot of great artists at that time. I mean, I mentioned that one of the songs that she sang on Amazing Grace was Holy Holy, which was a Marvin Gaye song on his What's Going On album. And that was not a gospel song. It was on a secular album, but certainly lyrically and thematically in the way he sang it, it could have been a religious song. Curtis Mayfield, basically his entire catalog could be considered religious songs, even though he's sang in a secular group.
Mm-hmm. So why is it that we think of her now? I'm still flabbergasted that we don't really honor and talk a lot about her gospel music and the incredible success of that album. Instead, we look at her as, I think you used this phrase, American soul royalty. We think of those other songs.
Well, I think there's a few reasons for that. I think one reason is that those individual songs were so successful, which is great. I mean, they deserve all the success that they received. And I think also, too, those songs, you could hear them in, they can be background music for a romantic scene in a movie. They could be used for commercials, whereas her gospel songs need to be taken as a whole. They can't be divorced from the actual album or the recording. And I think, too, I think this is true with gospel music in general in this country, is that as influential as gospel music has been on American music, as influential as gospel has been on rock and roll and on jazz and on blues, gospel music is not taken as seriously and doesn't receive the attention as a whole that it should receive in this country. And I think Amazing Grace is part of that. It's even though it did sell a lot, even though it does have a devoted following, and even though it was hugely influential, especially on younger gospel singers, but also on rock musicians and jazz musicians to a certain extent, it's part of this whole way that gospel has been too overlooked in this country.
Mm-hmm. Take us back to her even earlier years, her first recording session in 1956.
Well, that was really something. I mean, she would have been 14 years old, and she was recording in her father's church. It was for a recording that would come out here in Chicago on Chess Records, and just to hear this, where she was, the songs Never Grow Old and There's a Fountain Filled with Blood, I mean, these are some really spine-tingling gospel songs in and of themselves. And then to hear this young girl sing them with such fervor, and you wonder, where is this coming from? And this young girl to sing with such, I mean, it goes beyond passion, and so it's really frightening, and especially when she shouts out, old, old, and never grow old, and she revisited that song on Amazing Grace, and, you know, to hear, you know, her sing it as a 30-year-old, then compare it to how she sang as a 14-year-old, it's, my God, how far she's come.
Mm-hmm. And I guess we should talk a little bit, Aaron, about her vocal technique, how many octaves she could reach. Is there something extraordinary about her range?
Well, it's an incredibly extraordinary range. I mean, at that time, I mean, she could easily do 3.5 octaves, and which was really incredible for a singer. And so to really, if one of the things that made Amazing Grace such a successful album was that in addition to her being able to sing for 12 minutes, 13 minutes, she had the range to do all sorts of different things within that time frame that she gave to each song. And so that's why it's constantly exciting that she was able to pull these notes that no other singer could touch.
Mm-hmm. Who were her buddies in the music world?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because, you know, she's maintained friendships with some people whose styles are not that similar. She was a lifelong friend of Smokey Robinson. And the entire, like, Motown family were friends of hers. So even though, of course, her style and singing style and approach was very different than the Motown style, I mean, she was friendly with Smokey Robinson. She was friendly with, she was quite close to Dennis Edwards of the Temptations, actually. They were more than friends. But and then she was friends with people like Curtis Mayfield. She was friends with a whole range, of course, of gospel singers, too. And that's one of the interesting things is that younger gospel singers like Vanessa Bell Armstrong, who was from Detroit. And when I saw Aretha Franklin perform last year, she had Vanessa Bell Armstrong's nephew on drums. So she's always stayed close. Inez Andrews, the great gospel singer, and she uses Inez's son in her band as well. So she's always like stayed close to these gospel families as well, even using their offspring as side people as well to this day.
Let's talk about other people that she influenced. Could we include the Rolling Stones?
Yes, well, there's a really interesting story about that, and particularly with the Amazing Grace album. When Aretha Franklin was recording Amazing Grace in 1972, Sidney Pollack had a film crew there, and the film have never been released. But in working on this book, I saw the raw footage of the film, and in one very, very clear spot, you can see Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts in the footage. And the Rolling Stones were in Los Angeles putting the finishing touches on their Exile on Main Street album. And on the Exile on Main Street album, there were some really clear gospel influences. Shine a Light, I Just Want to See His Face. The Rolling Stones had as a sideman keyboardist Billy Preston, who was a student of the Reverend James Cleveland. So even though American audiences don't fully appreciate gospel, British rock and roll bands, particularly the Rolling Stones, did. And then, of course, the other Rolling Stone, Keith Richards, performed with Aretha Franklin later on. And which is funny because when people ask me, you said that Mick Jagger and Charlie Watts were in the audience that day. Where was Keith Richards that day? And I'm like, yeah, where do you think? And certainly the Rolling Stones.
Let's listen to the Rolling Stones. Rolling Stones and Shine a Light. This hour on the Ideas Network, we're paying tribute to Aretha Franklin and particularly to her gospel music as she will be inducted in August of this year into the Gospel Music Hall of Fame. And we'd like to welcome your phone calls or emails. I know that many of you listening have listened to Aretha Franklin for many hours of your life and that she holds a special place in your heart. Why is it, do you think, that we remember her more for her secular music than for her gospel music, when indeed it is her soul and it is her roots, and that album, Amazing Grace, that Aaron writes about is the most overlooked, but also the biggest seller of her entire career. So, or questions you may have about her life, we certainly welcome your phone calls. Here's how you reach us, 800-486-8255. 800-480-8655. Lines are open if you want. If not, you're just listening. That's fine. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. And our guest is Aaron Cohn, reviews editor for Downbeat Magazine and author of the book Amazing Grace. Going back to the film, the Sidney Pollack film that you just mentioned, why hasn't that ever seen the light of day, Aaron?
Well, after Sidney Pollack filmed it, it had sort of sat on the shelf at Warner Brothers. They originally wanted to release it as a double feature with Superfly, which...
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it didn't really make much sense.
No.
And I love the Superfly soundtrack, but again, as a film, very different. I mean, Wattstax, actually, a documentary would have been a good double feature. But anyway, so it sat in the Warner Brothers archives, and it's kind of been forgotten about. And there's recently been a movement to try to get it released, but there are some legal issues involved with the participants and getting all of that worked out. So there are still, and I think this is a true with a lot of music documentaries, is that it's a problem getting legal clearance.
Hmm.
I think the legalities of it are an issue. And also, too, I think it's only been in the last few years that we've seen really great films from that era being released. There was a great film that came out about a year ago, The Black Power Mixtape, which was a Swedish documentary about the Black Panthers and other Black Power groups from that time that only came out recently. When We Were Kings, about the Ali Foreman fight in Zaire, came out much, much, much later than it was made. So I think these films about especially Black culture of the 1970s, there's been a delay in getting them out. But I, having seen all those films and having seen this Amazing Grace film, I think that this Amazing Grace film towers above them all.
Hmm.
So I hope to see it released someday.
Yeah, I do too. Do you think Aretha Franklin wants to see it released?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay.
She, in her memoirs, which she wrote with David Ritz a number of years ago, she seemed kind of ambivalent about it. So I really don't know what she's thinking.
Let's go to phone calls. Mark, our first caller from Milwaukee. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
Good.
Good.
I just mentioned that a number of years ago I bought a 2-CD pack of a CD she recorded early in her career called Jazz to Soul, which kind of really shows her range across gospel, but also jazz standards that she did when she was very young. And it's one of the best CDs I've had in a long time.
Oh, absolutely. Those the Jazz to Soul recordings were taken from her years at Columbia, which she was at before she signed to Atlantic. And I think her jazz training that really came out during those years, and the Jazz to Soul is a great title for that collection. And that's another aspect of her career that is very, very underrated, were her early years singing standards, singing jazz-influenced songs, and singing jazz for Columbia. Those songs were not the big hits that she had later, but they were certainly important for her as an artist. And I think that music holds up very, very well now, 50 years later.
Mm. Was it, do you think, that she was just a little late, that jazz peaked in this country maybe a little bit earlier?
Well, I think part of the problems was that the songs were not marketed the way they should have been. I think the song, I'm referring to her Columbia jazz recordings. They found a significant African-American audience, but they for some reason just didn't cross over to a larger white audience, but they were certainly great records. She was performing on bills with people like Thelonious Monk, so she was certainly absorbing a lot and recording great, great songs in the jazz tradition. I think had she caught on, she could have been a first-rate jazz singer or a first-rate Broadway singer, too. She had those ambitions.
Oh,
well,
I never thought of that, sure.
Sure, Judy Garland was a particularly big influence on her.
Huh. Let's go to Chris in Black River Falls. Hi, Chris.
Hi, I just wanted to say that, you know, she has such a true voice when, and she's always kept true to her voice. And now that he had mentioned Judy Garland, I agree that she had the range and she had the, you know, the timbres in her voice that she'd be able to do that. And I'm glad to hear this show because a lot of times you don't get to hear certain parts of those types of music because of where you live. So I think it's cultural, too, because that's just the way it is. You know, like when I was a young person, I lived in the lower part of the Wisconsin, and we had an opportunity to hear so much more different type of music than what we do here. And we're only like 2 or 3 hours away from there. So that makes a big difference, too. but she's an amazing voice, and I'm glad to have this program on. Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Thank you for listening. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly true. And that's another reason why a lot of those, whether they were Aretha Franklin's jazz recordings early on or Amazing Grace or gospel recording, was that the lines of communication throughout America weren't what they should have been. And in the book, I talk about some of the challenges that Atlantic had in marketing the album initially. And the different regions in America were certainly part of the issue in getting the album to people's attention.
Let's go next to Ken in Winona. Hi, Ken.
Hello, it's Ken in Monona, Wisconsin.
Oh, Ken in Monona. Hi.
Oh, hey.
Yeah, I've got a humanitarian story I'd like to share, if you got time. My niece, Carrie, was dying of lung cancer, and she was an absolute huge, huge fan of Aretha Franklin, and had a chance to go down to the Oprah show. Oprah people were good enough to give her a couple of tickets when Aretha was going to be in Chicago. And there was no way that Oprah people could get Aretha Franklin to visit my niece, but they found the backup singers, and they slipped them a note, and the backup singer said, well, we can give Aretha the note, but we can't promise anything. So the note came back and said, stand at this backstage door on the street after the show, and we'll see what happens. Well, they waited there for about half an hour after the show, and Carrie was in a wheelchair, and here this big black limo pulls up, and the window comes down, and this hand comes out, and she's waving to my niece. And the driver, they stopped, and the chauffeur got out, opened the door for Aretha. Aretha came over and visited with Carrie in the wheelchair, standing on the street there, and we've got pictures of them both hugging. She's just she, besides being a great, great singer, she's a great humanitarian, too.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. You know, that's certainly true. And she's given a lot of money to charities throughout her career. And she's given a lot to individuals on a one-to-one basis as well, like with your niece. And that's a beautiful, beautiful story.
Yeah. It's how kind you are in life. You
Absolutely.
Can be really talented, but those
Absolutely.
Kinds of stories are wonderful.
Absolutely.
Just
very,
wonderful.
Very moving.
Wonderful to hear. We're talking this hour about Aretha Franklin and having such a good time doing so. Last week, the Gospel Music Hall of Fame announced that Aretha will be inducted in August. And we're talking about her career, her legacy, with a special emphasis on gospel music and the making of the album, her all-time best-selling album, Amazing Grace, recorded at Watts in 1972. Our guest is Aaron Cohen, reviews editor for Downbeat magazine and author of the book Amazing Grace. Aretha Franklin, soon to be inducted in the Gospel Music Hall of Fame. And we're welcoming phone calls. Lines are open now. They were busy. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email, if you'd like. That's talk@WPR.org. Or you can go to the Kathleen Dunn Show. Aaron, we heard in the last year about health scares that she had, and it was always kind of amorphous. Nobody ever knew what was happening. I don't think anybody knows now. Do you know?
Well, I think she wants to keep it private, which is her right, her prerogative. I will say this, though. When I saw her in last May of 2011 in Chicago at the Chicago Theater, that was her first full-length performance since all of these health scares became news. And she was incredible. I mean, I'd seen her before, but I'd never seen her perform with such a great will to live and such an energy and such dynamism. And she really just, every note she sang, she was just so happy to be alive, that I'm so happy to be performing, so happy to be in front of people. It was a sheer, sheer joy. Mm. So I can tell you that much, that when I saw her sing after all this news happened, she was quite, quite happy and elated to be alive, and I'm sure that's how she sounds today, too.
Mm-hmm. How many children does she have?
Let's see. She has four sons.
Four sons. And do any of them sing?
Well, she had a son, Teddy, who plays music, and a son, Kikal, who is a Christian rapper. And her son, Eddie, she is actually trying to record right now. So her sons are involved in music as well.
A Christian rapper?
Yes. I haven't heard him. I haven't heard him. But I know he opened for her in New York not long ago. So, but I haven't heard him. He was the son with her that she had with Ken Cunningham, who was her boyfriend at the time of Amazing Grace.
Let's go to David in Chautauqua. Hi, David.
Good morning.
Yeah, hi, David.
I just wanted to say I'm a voice teacher and I've sung professionally for many years. I'm an opera singer.
Oh.
But there's hardly anything more in human life that's more plastic than the voice. Basically, what I've run into with my own singing and teaching and everything is if a child is brought up with no borders, not to be told, oh, you've got to sing the high notes this way, you got to sing the low notes this way, or you don't fit into the schablone you want to get into, opera, musicals, whatever. Children can grow up with just the most amazing vocal range you've ever heard anywhere. Aretha Franklin is certainly, most absolutely, one of the greatest versatile singers with her voice that has ever lived. And thank God we've got recordings to hear her. But the part of the problem, I'm convinced, is the fact that we put kids, well, you're going to sing classical, you're going to sing musical, you're going to sing pop. And I think there's an awful lot of kids out there who are capable of going in the direction of Aretha. I don't see they could ever be as good as Aretha. But to have a more flexible voice, we kind of pigeonhole kids.
Well, that's a fascinating comment.
That is, and that's one of the things that I've always appreciated about gospel music, is that when I go to gospel churches here in Chicago where I live, people are encouraged to get up and sing, and they aren't told, okay, you have to sing this way, you have to sing this note. They have a platform to sing, a space to sing, a space to express how they feel, where they're not being judged. They're not being, whether they're, you know, young children, whether they're middle-aged, whether they're grown, whether they're senior citizens. In a gospel church, they have a space to do and sing and be themselves. And although I asked a reverend about that, and I mentioned that, he said, well, yes, but if we're going to ask you back, you still have to be good.
It's a good comeback. Bill, thanks very much for
Thank
your
you.
Call, David. Bill, oh, before we go to Bill, what about opera? Do you think Aretha could have done opera? Has she ever done opera?
Well, you know, she did that Nessu Dorma.
Oh, yes, right.
Where she had to fill in for an ailing Pavarotti.
Right.
And, so I, as far as if she could have done opera, well, I'm not an expert in opera, so I really can't say. That's not my area, but it would have been interesting.
Right.
It would have been interesting.
Bill in Burlington, hi.
Hi, I just wanted to bring up, you were talking about the potential of Aretha as a doing musical numbers and things like that, a la Judy Garland. And I just wanted to bring up her her fantastic number in the Blues Brothers. She did sing in that.
Yes,
and that
I
was
saw
a great
it.
Musical number. And she, as soon as she started hitting the notes, the Blues Brothers both turned around because they know they had nothing to, they had
right,
no reply
right.
to the power of her singing. She was just fantastic.
Yeah, well, that was certainly the best scene in the movie. And yeah, that was a great performance.
That was great. How old was she? I just saw that last week. My son was watching it. How old was she in that film?
Well, she was born in 1942, and the film was made in 1979.
Oh.
It came out in 1980. So, you know, she would have been in her upper 30s at the time. And but that would have been the first time I saw Aretha, because I saw that film when I was 11. So that would have been my first time seeing Aretha Franklin perform, would be in the film The Blues Brothers.
Was she deserving of the Rolling Stone naming her the greatest singer of the rock era?
Well, I think so. I certainly think so. And there's certainly been some great singers. Sam Cooke, who was, of course, a hero.
He was a
of
great
hers,
singer.
Great
yes.
singer. But certainly I would pick Aretha Franklin, for sure.
Let's go. Thank you, Bill, for the call.
Thank you.
We go to Gene in Wauwatosa. Hi, Gene. Gene, are you there? Gina's gone. All right, our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Send an email, too, if you'd like. We have lines open for you. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You mentioned Whitney Houston recently died. Were Aretha and Whitney Houston friends at all? Did she comment on her passing?
Well, Whitney Houston's mother, Sissy Houston, was a gospel singer, and Sissy Houston sang backup for Aretha Franklin. So when Whitney Houston was born, and when she was a little girl, she would go and see Aretha in the studio. She would see Aretha up close. She would be in Aretha's presence quite often throughout her career. And then in the 1980s, when Whitney Houston started having hits, crossover hits, that was when Aretha Franklin had her pop comeback with Who's Zoomin' Who and songs like Freeway of Love. So they knew each other. They were sort of chasing each other on the pop charts for a while in the mid-80s. And then when Whitney Houston so tragically died recently, Aretha Franklin commented how shocked and saddened she was. As far as if they retained a close friendship, that I don't know. But I do know that Aretha Franklin, just like many people who knew Whitney Houston and people who are fans of Whitney Houston, were very shocked and saddened by her untimely passing.
We'll take more phone calls momentarily. 800-486-8655 is our number. We'll play a little bit of Whitney Houston.
How will I know if he really loves me? I say a prayer with every heartbeat. I fall in love whenever we meet. I'm asking you because you know about these things. How will I know if he's thinking of try to phone, but I'm too shy. Can't speak. Falling in love is so bittersweet. This love is strong. Why do I feel weak?
Aretha Franklin, that's Whitney Houston, but we're talking about Aretha Franklin this hour. Interesting to know that Whitney's mother was a backup for Aretha Franklin, Sissy Houston. We're talking about her being inducted into the Gospel Music Hall of Fame, which will take place, and also because we thought it was a perfect chance to do a show, quite frankly, on Aretha Franklin.
Any excuse,
I know, but this is a really good one. It's legitimate, too, don't you think?
Well, I think so,
Aaron,
too. And
it is.
It's kind of interesting that it's sort of taken so long for the Gospel Hall of Fame to induct her. I think they should have done it years ago, but it's not up to me to make these decisions.
I'm with you. Let's go to Dave in Madison. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning, Aaron. Hopefully my cell phone holds out. Quickly about the dynamics between Aretha and her father in terms of personal dynamics. Could the record be seen as sort of a message to her father that she hadn't really left the church?
I think so. And then in her father... on the album, her father says that she's never left the church. And her father, who had been, of course, a great church leader in Detroit, was sort of at the end, going into the end of his career at that time. So that was like sort of like the last hurrah for her father in a very public way. And it was also, her way of sort of having her father there at her shining moment as a gospel singer. And so, yes, I think the dynamic between Aretha Franklin and her father is very present on the album, along with his speech on the album, and there's a version of the album that came out a few years ago on Rounder, which has the complete spoken parts, the complete sermons, where her father goes into great detail about how he feels Aretha has never left the church. So it was very much a part of that whole story that he's felt on the album even when he's not speaking.
Jesse is next in Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Jesse.
Good morning. How are you?
All right. How are you?
Fine, thank you. I just wanted to quickly thank you and Mr. Cohn for this wonderful tribute to a singular voice. And also just to mention that for a young person, for a person who was young, I should say, back in the late 60s when Aretha first came to great prominence on the Atlantic label, her spirit and her soul were a vital part of the Black is Proud Be yes. Black and Proud movement. Yeah. She was kind of following in the footsteps of her own father, who was a great civil rights figure. And I remember when her first big record came out, Never Loved a Man the Way I Loved You, the disc jockeys in Chicago did something that they almost never did. They played the song repeatedly over and over again as if they knew something special was happening. And it truly was the burgeoning of rhythm and blues as a as not just an entertainment force, but also as a force, as a movement of pride in ourselves and in what we were doing. So I just wanted to make that point.
Oh, that's
absolutely
great.
Absolutely. And those Chicago DJs, particularly Purvis Spann, E. Rodney Jones, were quite prominent in crowning her the Queen of Soul. And I think the way she took that, especially with the Amazing Grace album and the cover art, where she's wearing what would become known as Afrocentric clothing, she was clearly identifying with the black pride, Black is Beautiful movement, by wearing this sort of Afrocentric clothing, which no other pop soul singer was doing. I mean, you could not imagine Diana Ross dressing like Aretha Franklin does on the cover of Amazing Grace.
I love what Jesse said, too, because you can't say this about too many performers. Let's play that again. Let's play that again.
Oh,
I love it. Isn't it true? Is your book available widely?
Yes, it is.
All right.
Available wherever books are sold.
All right. Thanks, Aaron. Aaron Cohen, our guest. His book is Amazing Grace. Congratulations, Aretha Franklin, on being inducted into the Gospel Music Hall of Fame. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and to Rhonda Fanning for putting together a whale of a show. This was great fun. Let's do it again. Let's do the hour again. Well, we'll talk about her again. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We, of course, have to end with some Aretha.